You're listening to Christian Humanism, What is a Person and Why Should We Care? By Dr. Jens Zimmermann. Dr. Zimmermann is J.I. Packer Chair of Theology at Regent College in Vancouver, British Columbia. This breakout session was recorded at the Apologetics Canada Conference 2020 on March 7th at Northview Community Church in Abbotsford, British Columbia. For more resources, please visit us at apologeticscanada.com.
Okay, well, welcome to this, what must seem like a bit of a strange title to you, Christian Humanism, What is a Person and Why Should We Care? Now, this session is really about personhood and what it means to be a person. But I threw in the term Christian Humanism because when we talk about personhood, as we tried to make clear last night on the panel, we need a Christian, biblical, sort of anthropological framework for it. And over the years, I've come to be convinced that this framework is really what I call Christian Humanism. And so what I want to do in our session today is basically start out by defining and explaining to you what Christian Humanism is. And then, secondly, I want to tell you how Christian Humanism, or this biblical conception of what it means to be human, contributed to the birth of the concept of the person. And then finally, because by now you're probably bored, I thought we'd go to two concrete examples of why personhood matters. And the two examples, I will take one from bioethics, from euthanasia, from the euthanasia debate, really, and the other one from the area of technology. And since it's so funkily futuristic, I'll take the transhumanism topic and the idea of mind uploading to talk about why it matters that we understand what it is to be a person. So I'm sorry to say that what you're getting, I'm a dyed-in-the-wool academic. I'm trained as an academic. I'm not trained as a pastor. So I'm very text-bound. This is what university students experience when they get a lecture. And that's sort of what you're getting. I'll try to, you know, be as non-lecturesque as possible, but we'll see how that goes. So let's start out with Christian humanism. What is it? Well, simply put, Christian humanism is the gospel. I say it provocatively. Christian humanism is the good news of our salvation as proclaimed really largely by the early church, and it filters down into the Reformation age. You see, for early church theologians, the founding mystery of the Christian faith was the incarnation, and the gospel was essentially this. The gospel, the good news of our salvation. In Jesus Christ, the eternal Logos of God, in, through, and for whom all things were created. In him, God became human to show us the true image of God, in order that through union with Christ, we could become fully, truly human. So that's, to me, the promise of our salvation. And the whole focus of this early church was precisely on the wonder that God chose as a means of our salvation to become a human being, to become human, not any other possible way, to enter into his creation, into humanity, to change it and redeem it from the inside out. Now, if you know your New Testament, you will recognize that this view of salvation comes straight from John's gospel and from the letters of the Apostle Paul. The one through whom everything has been created, the light of the world, comes into the world. And this is, of course, the Messiah Christ, who becomes the second humanity, the kind of second Adam, the true image and likeness of God, who in his death and resurrection reconciles all things to God. For what purpose? To create in himself one new humanity, Ephesians 1:15 says. One new humanity, a humanity of unity and of peace. And according to the New Testament, the whole point of Christianity then is to become more fully human by putting on Christ so that we may all become transformed, both body and soul, the total human being, into the likeness of this true image of God. So Paul tells us to put off the old human being I put the Greek there just to sound scholarly. And to put on the new human being, created according to the likeness of God in true righteousness and holiness. Now, some of our Bibles have done us a real disservice by translating the term anthropos and neon-anthropos, the new human being and the old human being. The older scriptures had man, right? The old man, the new man. But that was politically incorrect. So we changed it to self, the old self and the new self. But in our psychologized environment, that doesn't sound like a whole lot. Like a new self, like what exactly is that? New attitude of mind? The biblical word is the new human being. Put on the new humanity of Christ. It makes a big difference in how you read the scriptures and how you perceive the promise. Because then your redemption is not merely some kind of inner moral transformation. It is the whole transformation of the whole human being, both body and soul. And for Paul, the whole purpose of the Christian life then is to become transformed into this new human being, being renewed, he says, in the image of its creator in Colossians. Put on Christ, he says, so that by God's grace, through our union with Christ, what was created mortal may become immortal. And, of course, this transformation into the new humanity, which is Christ, into the new humanity, Christ has already accomplished. It's already there in him. Yeah, so if you're looking for the new transformed humanity, it's already there in Christ. And this humanity, again, is transformed in its totality, soul and body, our whole psychological, our whole material being. This is very important when we come to the examples at the end, as you will see. And so according to the New Testament, Christianity is all about becoming truly human by becoming Christ-like. Now, some of you, this being sort of an evangelical gathering, might think, well, I thought salvation is about justification by faith. I thought salvation is about, you know, the defeat of sin and death and so on, and then to become sanctified. All true. But I mean, the total end of all of these things, you're not justified by faith for nothing. For what are you justified? Sin and death are defeated, that's fine, but what are you living for? For the older church, the whole point was that God became human, showing us what our end goal is, namely to become, in soul and body, a human being in a transformed way, that the risen Christ is also a human being. Which, by the way, creates this oddity, which you have to think about, that even right now, the Trinity somehow includes a glorified, incarnate human being. I'll just let that sit for you to think about theologically. So, if you agree with me that this sounds like a thoroughly biblical picture of our salvation, then you may be less shocked to hear that for over 1,000 years, Christian theologians have called this thing deification, or theosis in Greek, becoming godlike. And what they meant by this term is exactly what I just explained to you, namely the Christification, the becoming like Christ, or becoming like God by growing into the likeness of Christ, the true image of God, in whose image we were created. So that's basically the core of what I call Christian humanism. And I want to conclude this all too brief introduction, because we need to move on, with a quotation from the 4th century theologian, Basil of Caesarea, who defines deification, just in case this still sounds extreme to you, with these lines, namely precisely as God-likeness. He says, if you become a hater of evil, free of rancor, if you become brother-loving and compassionate, you are deified. You are like God. If you forgive your enemy from your heart, you are like God. If as God is toward you a sinner, you become the same toward the brother who has wronged you, or by your goodwill from your heart toward your neighbor, you are like God. And it wasn't until the early 20th century, by the way, around the same time when the term secular humanism was born, that precisely this view of salvation became known as Christian humanism. And I deliberately give you here a Protestant reference by the theologian Emil Brunner, who wrote in 1948, he defined this Christian humanism in his Gifford lectures like this. He says, behind Christian humanism stands as its basic foundation the faith in that man in whom both the mystery of God and the secret of man have been revealed in one. The belief, Christian humanism, is the belief that the creator of the universe attaches himself to man, that he in whose creative word the whole structure of the universe has its foundation, has made known as his world purpose the restoration and perfection of his image in human beings. Christian humanism is to believe that therefore not only the history of humanity, but the history of the whole cosmos shall be consummated in God humanity. So this is really interesting. I mean, I could talk forever, but just the fact that Emil Brunner in his Gifford lectures was a prestigious set of lectures given by select academics in Edinburgh and Scotland, did this in 1948, which is of course the time when Europe had its greatest turmoil behind it with the Holocaust, the Nazi regime, Brunner being a Swiss German. So they're looking for the reestablishment of a healthy and decent society on some foundation. For Brunner, Christian humanism was supposed to be that foundation. But we need to move on because I'm going to cover some stuff. So it should be clear from what we've heard so far that Christian humanism, or to use another term, an understanding of salvation based on the incarnation, must be our departure point when we talk about what it means to be human. And there's little doubt, I think, as you've got from this whole event, that this question of what it means to be human lies at the heart of many, perhaps all, of the most pressing social issues today. Quite a while back, 2005, I think it was, the Catholic theologian Joseph Ratzinger, better known as Pope Benedict XVI, the only German pope they've ever had, was bang on when he wrote in his first encyclical in 2005 called Love and Truth. He said that we need to affirm today that the social question has become radically an anthropological question. The social question has become radically, at its root, an anthropological question. So in other words, if we don't know what it means to be human, we can't negotiate all these problems. And throughout this encyclical, Ratzinger emphasizes the importance of personhood to address this anthropological question and therefore the social issues. So he urges the church to lead society in asserting and justifying the unconditional worth of the human person and the meaning of a person's growth. So we need to respect, he says, in all areas that shape our culture, so economics, medicine, technology, and so on, together with the educational administrative aspects, the dignity we accord to each person. And we must ensure the holistic development of the person if we want a humane and healthy society. And I think that remains very much true. Now, identifying human beings as persons may not sound like a big deal to you, because nowadays we've become so used to the language of the person's human dignity and human rights that we have forgotten the historical roots of these concepts. So, for example, when you read in the UN Declaration that the fundamental rights, human rights, rest on the dignity and worth of the human person, not many of us will know that this concept is the fruit of a long historical development in which Christianity played a really crucial role. Now, let me just unpack that a little bit. For you see, up to the arrival of Christianity on the world scene, the ancient world really had no category for a person. For a person as a unique individual whose particular choices could transcend natural inclinations. The best antique version of what it means to be a human being was basically something like this. The whole cosmos is animated by an impersonal divine ordering principle or logos, and human beings are special because their reasoning power indicates a divine spark in them from this logos that sets them apart from the animals and requires of them to live a life according to this rational nature. And I want you to note then three important things about this ancient pre-Christian view of human identity, and then we'll look at these three things in terms of Christianity. So the first is that the unique status of being human depends on a certain capability, namely the power of reason, of reflective abstract reasoning. The ancients thought that unlike animals or stupid people, we don't examine the actions, we are truly human and truly free when we rationalize our actions in light of the truth. We are, as you all know the phrase, rational animals. The second thing we note is that the impersonal and abstract universal nature of truth. Truth is impersonal, truth is abstract. Truth consists of universal, pure ideas like justice, beauty, or goodness. To be truly human means, yes, indeed, independent thought, but it's in the service of ideas. Individuals are important only insofar as they play their role in allowing the truth to appear. So ancient philosophers could talk about a common brotherhood of all people, but only in the sense that we're all part of some totality for which you should sacrifice yourself. People are thus expendable for the greater good, for the state, for the collective, whatever. And then finally, note that to the ancient mind, the access to this truth is knowledge. Humans are free when they submit to the rule of truth through knowledge. And so for philosophers like Plato, for example, the only reason you're not following the truth is ignorance, because you don't know. If you could show Plato that people who really know the truth, that there are people who really know the truth, but are unwilling to follow it, and you ask him, why is that, Plato? He would respond the way Siri responded to me lately when I asked Siri, do you love nature? I don't have an answer for that. Is there something else I can help you with? So, in other words, Plato would not really understand the question you're asking. And this takes us to what I would call the Christian revolution that lays the foundation for the person. So with the arrival of Christianity, these three defining aspects we've mentioned, that define human worth, a rational agency, human worth measured by greater totality, and enlightenment through knowledge, they change profoundly because of Christ. How do they change? So first, according to the New Testament, the worth of a human being does not depend on rational capability, but on our being made in God's image, which is way bigger than just rational ability. The sacredness of a human being derives not from the ability to reason, but from being in God's image and therefore destined for personal communion with God. So you can note here that what a person's worth no longer depends on a certain capacity. That becomes important later on. And then second, in the New Testament, truth is not an abstract universal, but truth is ultimately another person, the incarnate Christ. God is truth. And so accordingly, we are not part of universal cosmic totality that gives us worth, but we ourselves are totalities in ourselves. We are particular individual persons who are known by this God that seeks communion with us. So you note here, it is no longer acceptable to sacrifice individuals to the greater collective or to the state, for the fatherland, and so on. This is, by the way, also the birth of genuine political resistance. And then third, in the New Testament, failure to live according to the truth and the rise of evil are not the result of ignorance, as for Plato, but of willful disobedience we call sin. And so this deepens this understanding of volition. To recognize truth, you need more than mere knowledge. It's not just, give me the information, I see the information, I will live accordingly. No, you need a change of heart. And this deepens the dimension of interiority that leads to personhood. With these profound transformative changes, then, to the ancient view of human identity, Christianity laid down the groundwork for the modern idea of the person. And this foundation was further deepened by theological discussions about the Trinity and Christology that led to the famous creedal formulations, which I'm sure you all know. The first one on the Trinity, as God is one being existing in three persons. And on Christology, Christ is both fully human and fully divine, uniting these two natures without commixture, without confusion, in one person. And so in both cases, the word person was used to help state divine mysteries. In the case of the Trinity, strict monotheists, which these early Jewish Christians were, had to articulate how could one God exist in the differentiation of Father, Son, and Spirit that the church was experiencing. They concluded that one and the same divine being or nature was differentiated as three hypostases or personal relations, if you will, three ways of having or enacting the same divine nature. The Greeks called this, as I just said, hypostases, three ways of self-existing being, and then later Latin theologians gave us the word persona, the person. Not three beings, but one being that exists in such a way that three persons enact, relate to this one divine nature, giving and receiving it in different personal relational ways to one another unceasingly. That was the definition of the Trinity. So not three somethings make up someone, but the personal God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, one God exists not in three modes or somethings, but three times someone. And then in case of Christ, the Christological debate, the word person was used to describe how Christ could be at the same time fully God and fully human. In Christ, the divine and human are not mixed, but they're held together by one person, the second person of the Trinity, the inner Trinitarian person we call God the Word, or God the Son, who revealed his person concretely then in Jesus. And these Christian impulses changed the ancient meaning of the word person. I don't know if you know this, but originally person refers to an actor. It's a mask, a persona is a mask that an actor holds through which he speaks, the role that he takes up. And then later the term was used to describe a person's social status or role in society. Thanks to Christianity, though, person came to mean the inner volitional center, the someone who exercises the social function, who relates to a nature. You can see this change when the Bible tells us that God does not regard the person, but judges the heart. So you see the inversion. God does not look on the outside, but on the inside. Back then, you called the outside the person. Now we call the heart the person. Yeah, that's the change that Christianity brought about. So from this discussion, later theologians deducted basically three truths about the person. I think they're worth noting then as we move into the second part. So first of all, then, a person is not defined by its nature. Rather, a person relates to the nature. It's the who that has a nature and therefore transcends it. It cannot be reduced to it. A person is not a what, but a who, not a something like a conglomeration of matter controlled by neural networks we call brain, but a someone who relates to and transcends all these things. Nor is a person simply an effect of genetic codes, evolutionary history, or cultural upbringing. To be sure, all these inform our personhood, but the person is she who has this nature, who enacts it in a unique, particular, irreplaceable way. Second, therefore, a person cannot be defined by any quality, like the capacity to reason. A person is not an assembly of qualities, as much as these make up, in some ways, who we are. Right? Whether you're smart or stupid or tall or small or reasonable or have the capacity of reason or not, and so on. But that is not the essence of a person. A person is the particular mode of existing that which enacts and employs these qualities. And then finally, following the model of the Trinity, a person is always someone in relation with others. The person is constituted as socially. Persons, you want to say, exist only in the plural. We're always persons in relation, and our dignity depends on the recognition by others. Now, obviously, from a Christian point of view, human beings therefore possess inviolable dignity because every human being is made in the image of God and known by God and destined for intimate communion with the triune God and with one another. As I said earlier, it is important that we follow the Bible in declaring Christ as God's true image so that we don't commit the mistake of defining the image narrowly as reason or even just as freedom. These need to be qualified in a Christic way as reason in terms of communion or freedom in order to be free for something, namely free for responsibility with one another, just the way Christ used his freedom for the sake of humanity and so on. So Christ shows us that the image of God that makes us person refers primarily to love of another. And this becomes very important in our second example, first example, sorry. So the image of God as love for another, personhood as love for another, the capacity for truthful, loving communion. So freedom and reason, two other standard interpretations of the image of God, should be seen as subservient to our capacity to love, and love as human persons. We'll see in a minute why this is really important. And so with that, we come to our last bit, namely these two examples, to see how all the stuff that we've been talking about matters when it comes to these two areas. So the first example we want to take from bioethics, and the second from technology. So the first is taken from the euthanasia debate and illustrates how important it is that we don't reduce the person, and in Christian language, I mean the image of God, to a certain capacity. When we define a person according to certain abilities, we wrongly separate the person from the human being with its body and social relations, from the totality that God cares about. Here's the example, and you may know this already. The prominent Australian moral philosopher Peter Singer defines persons as sentient beings who are rational and self-conscious. That's what a person is, rational and self-aware. So any possible rights, the right to life, he proposed, should be extended only to what fits that definition, to a person. And then obviously consistent with this logic, he concludes that an embryo or severely handicapped human beings who demonstrate no obvious reasoning capacity are non-persons who may be killed. On the other hand, animals, and of course this works because Peter Singer is an animal rights activist, animals who show reasoning capacity, you know, like the monkey who goes and tries to get the banana in certain ways or whatever, they really are more of a person than the handicapped human being who doesn't have that reasoning capacity. And therefore, the human being could be dispatched, the animal should have the right to life. Now, Singer himself exemplifies the difficulty with this definition of personhood because he cared his whole later life lovingly for his mother, Cora, whose advanced condition of Alzheimer's rendered her totally a non-person according to Singer's own definition. And you know, every reporter that interviewed Singer, of course, went straight to that issue. And whenever he was asked, Singer admitted that the logical decision to end a non-rational human being's life becomes somewhat different when it is your mother. Somewhat. Why is it different? You know, he can't articulate. He said, well, I should dispatch her, I know. But, you know, it's not that easy. It's my mother, after all. So what's the hang-up here? I think it is that the cold logic of his reductive definition really runs up against the existential phenomenon of the person. Singer completely overlooks that the person is defined in social terms. So the social dimension we talked about earlier, based on the Trinitarian conception of personhood, is something that eludes him. The philosopher Robert Spemann, whom I'm very fond of, he's a German Catholic philosopher, has written lots on personhood, if you're interested in that. He has written that the person exists only in the plural. What Spemann means is that our self-consciousness as persons is only possible with reference to another person. If you think about this carefully, every area of your human life that is self-reflective really exists only or is always conducted with the eye of another on you in some sense. Yeah, I can't explain all this, but I think it's really true. So consciousness is intrinsically relational. My very identity as someone requires consciousness of someone else. We only know objectively who we are in being known by other people. The other person establishes myself as yet another and also provides an objective limit to my own reflective egocentrism. Right? I mean, if you really want to know what you're like, don't keep asking yourself, right? I mean, talk to other people. You may not like that, but that's how you get actual self-knowledge. The objectivity of our self-knowledge is based on this personal reciprocal I-thou relation. And person exists only in the plural because being known by another person grounds and structures the world openness that makes us persons. I know myself as part of another self-transcendent person's world, and I also know that she knows herself as part of mine. And so if you start thinking like this, this goes back to my comments about algorithms, there's nothing like this that even remotely is true of machine reasoning. You can't even call it that. So this interpersonal relation that constitutes our human reality plays itself out right from birth when parents interact with a child as personal other. Indeed, for personal philosophers like John McMurray, the mother-child relation exemplifies the personal mutuality that is the basic form of our human existence. The most basic unit of personal existence is not the individual. This is a lie that's sold to you by modern thought ever since the 18th century or so. But the basic form of personal existence are two persons in personal relation. McMurray says that the unity of the person is not the I, but the you and I. This means that we are persons not by individual right, but in virtue of our own relation to one another. And this sociality that defines us as persons requires a particular way of awareness, of being aware of a person. Because knowing another person is certainly not a matter of information, nor of detecting a certain capacity for self-consciousness. Rather, knowing another person requires what we call recognition, a mutual recognition, one person recognizes another as a person. Recognizing another person means to be aware of another self-transcendent, world-open self who also senses and acknowledges my personhood. And again, the highest form of recognizing and affirming another person in his or her embodied uniqueness is love. It is in love that we recognize and acknowledge another person, no matter what the capacities are, is a person. So love is willing to recognize and uphold the person even when her capabilities fail. So Singer is right, he just doesn't know it, to care for his mother because she is being known by him as the same person, whether she's completely lost her consciousness or not. Love between persons refuses to acknowledge, then, the reduction of personhood to rational self-awareness, and consequently, love grants this recognition to another even when her capacities change. Love ensures, in other words, the continuity of a person's identity in holding him or her in our memory, recognizing her as who she is in her total history and relations. And I think that's the only way you can cope with a phenomenon that you, like, you know, as I can see, for instance, my father change at 90, and you tend to think things like, well, he's no longer the same person that he once was. And as he slowly is losing his mind and going over to dementia, but it is us that in the loving communion of persons, we hold and acknowledge his dignity as the totality of the person that he is. And I think that's what Singer feels but can't articulate. It's different when it is your mother, right? So the person is no longer merely a social role, nor even a psychological profile, but it is that someone whose identity over time and throughout changing roles is recognized by another. Now, for me, the most powerful religious expression of this being known by another that makes us persons and holds our personhood is a poem by Dietrich Bonhoeffer, which I can't give you in its entirety. I don't know if you know the poem. It's called Who Am I? He's written that in prison. And it's precisely the situation where this Lutheran theologian Nazi resistor exemplifies this understanding of personhood. Now, Bonhoeffer is here incarcerated, he's incriminated, state traitor, torn from his upper bourgeois privileges and from his supportive family. And here Bonhoeffer in prison becomes uncertain whether his identity, as he puts it, lay in the proud, authoritative bearing natural to him that impressed even his prison guards who treated him with respect, or in the coward he tried to hide. His response illustrates the social self. So you have just a snippet of the poem there. And you can see, if you read the poem, you can see how he's, you know, he wonders, like, am I this? Am I the other? Who am I? Am I both? Am I neither? And his final response is exactly illustrates this, that being known anchors our personhood. You see, ends the poem, as you can see. They haunt me, these questions of mine, but you know me. I am thine. So here you have a profound religious expression, Christian expression of personal identity. And just as God is the anchor of our identity, so we ensure human dignity, which is not something that lies out there to be granted, that it's something that we need to grant and recognize in people. And we ensure human dignity when we recognize the personhood and dignity of others, no matter what physical or mental state they're in. So that was our first example. You see how personhood matters in terms of the euthanasia debate. The second comes from technology. It's maybe a little bit more lighthearted, because those guys are just crazy. It's my firm scholarly opinion. Okay, our second example for why personhood matters is in assessing contemporary social issues about technology. Now, we've talked about this already for a day. Technology has become almost like the air we breathe. We barely notice how the nature of technology subtly but constantly changes our understanding of what it means to be human. I mean, not only are our lives suffused with technology, but our daily use of social media, particularly, and computers for work and so on, becomes intrinsically dependent on artificial intelligence, and that intelligence that feeds your Google engines and WhatsApp and so on is directly linked, and by the way, your data are constantly used for that, to fuel a billion-dollar industry dedicated to enhancing human abilities, to eradicating disease along with aging, and to achieve immortality via technology. These futuristic goals are championed by an increasingly powerful movement we've identified as transhumanism already. Now, transhumanists are basically started as a bunch of software engineers and computer scientists, heavily weighted in Silicon Valley, which explains the narcissism of the whole thing, who team up with neuroscientists in the pursuit of merging humans and artificial intelligence to create a new human species free from all our current limitations. Now, I don't really believe that they will actually accomplish the futuristic goals, but I do think transhumanism helps us as sort of this external, extreme fringe to see how technology changes our understanding of what it means to be human. So transhumanism is, for me, a convenient shorthand of our general tech chauvinism. And by tech chauvinism, I mean the blind optimism about technology and an abundant lack of caution about how new technologies will be used. Technology is simply the solution for everything. If there's a problem, it's got to be a technological solution. And pretty soon, every problem looks like a technological difficulty that we can fix. So, for example, the transhumanist Ray Kurzweil is famous for predicting that by 2045, we'll be able to upload our minds to computing platforms like the cloud. Let's see if there he is. So 2045, this is going to happen. And as you know, Kurzweil pops a whole bunch of vitamin pills to keep his body ready for the time when we can merge. Now, like Christian end-time prophets, Kurzweil keeps revising these dates very carefully, but he does. But what interests us really is the technological claim itself. Will the day come when you can upload your mind? You know, there are people that wear a medal, and when they interacted with one of them, Anders Sandberg. So wear this medal, and when you're in an accident and it's fatal, then the paramedics know right away that your body is to be transported to a cryo chamber where either your head is cut off, depending on how you pay, or your whole body is frozen until the time that technology is able to, do this remastering of the brain. There is, if you're looking for a business opportunity, there it is. So let's look at this idea of mind uploading in light of the personhood, which is the whole point. So it's important to note that by mind, Kurzweil means our personality profile, ourselves, really a replica of our actual selves. And as I said, the motivation for this dream is actually quite touching. Kurzweil misses his father and wants to bring him back by creating a computer replica of his personality, and he wants to do it by feeding all these things. Like, he's got this whole room full of stuff, right? Everything his dad has ever done, touched, and articulated, voice recordings, letters, compositions, photos of his interaction with people, all these kind of things, all gets fed into this information, gets all collected, fed into a machine. And then the algorithms and the design, they will create this avatar. So you switch on the screen and, you know, presumably would say, hello, dad, hello, son. So if you object that even if this worked, you would end up not with a real person, but with a simulation, with a replica. Kurzweil's answer to you would be that this doesn't really matter, because that's really what we are. All we are patterns of information. Personal identity is really nothing but input and output patterns of information about your interactions, your emotional responses, and so on. And so the brain is essentially, for Kurzweil, a pattern recording and recognition device, much like a computer. It's a biological version. Transhumanists have an essential functionalist view of the brain. And the best popular depiction I've found of this view is how the killer robot Terminator perceives the world. I'll just show this briefly. But you see, as he walks into the bar, this is how he sees, right? Everything's a scan. Everything's a quantifiable information scan. So he's looking for an outfit that fits him. I don't know if you... This is an old, old movie by now. Yeah? So it's this sort of... This is how the transhumanists regard our brain to function. And once you've reduced our cognition to the brain and the brain to a biological machine, it is not that far a step to imagine that we can actually reverse engineer the brain and digitally remaster all of its functions, that we can upload our unique self-identity, which is merely information patterns, to digital memory devices, and either then enjoy a disembodied future or you download yourselves into any kind of cool synthetic body that technology can provide. I mean, sky's the limit, or your account. The problem with this whole scenario is that the human self, our personal identity, cannot be reduced to patterns of information exchange for the simple reason that this is not how we actually perceive and engage the world. I don't know how much you think about these things. So contrary to the claim of transhumanists, neither the brain nor human cognition work like a computer, but they depend utterly on an organic body to work, to perceive. For only the body perceives a dimension of reality that is entirely foreign to the machines, namely sentience or feeling. So, which sentience is sort of the lowest possible form of conscience or awareness through sensual experience and emotions. All living organisms, from the amoeba to the higher primates, possess a metabolism that transforms food into energy and thus puts a basic dynamic of striving and fulfillment of pain and satisfaction at the very heart of life. And this striving of living bodies opens up a depth dimension of existing, a differential between inside and outside, that is impossible without a living body. See, that's why I said that when somebody says things like, can an AI convince itself of not being AI? It's just completely crazy. Like, it's a category mistake to pose that question. So it is true, of course, that only in human persons does this awareness, this differential of inside and outside, become the kind of self-consciousness that makes us persons and so different from animals. Yet even our uniquely human perception remains reliant on that basic striving and fulfillment drive, and therefore reliant on our bodies. We don't negotiate the world as information processing algorithms. No, we skillfully navigate a world of human meaning and dimensions based on our ensouled bodies. When I say up and down, left and right, this is totally centered in my embodied self, which is why it's just a heck of a lot of work to get a computer and a robot to do the same things. Like what a child can do takes a room full of software to make it happen. And it'll never be the same anyway. So my point is that the person, this embodied someone who has a body, is only conscious by means of this body. Now, one of my favorite philosophers, Michael Polanyi, has expressed this way. He says, our body is the ultimate instrument of all our knowledge, whether intellectual or practical. In all our waking moments, we're relying on our awareness of contacts of our body with things outside for attending to these things. We need a body to be who we are as unique sentient persons. Our view of the world, our language, our intuitions, and our social selves, our whole basic understanding of the world depends on having a body. This is why these scientific scenarios, you know, these movies where there's a brain switch, right? The person switches. It can't work. You're not switching a person. You're transplanting a brain into another body. And this brain would kind of wake up and would be completely at odds. It couldn't even walk or do anything because you need the whole body that makes up the person, right? You can't just transfer a person like that. It's good sci-fi. It's just bad philosophy. So cognition is embodied, and so is the person. You can neither digitize the person nor can you upload the person. That's the point. So what do we conclude then? You've listened very patiently. So I don't think we should lose any sleep over the actual possibility that the futuristic vision of transhumanism will actually ever become a reality. The real issue for me is a battle for our imagination. The very technology we are inventing can harm us precisely because we're not merely animals, but persons who are malleable, who can envision and shape their nature. The more people like Kurzweil tell us that our human identity is like the profile stored in our smartphone, the more we might actually believe this to be true. Does not the way we pour ourselves into our social media accounts kind of convert us to this view in a way? I mean, it never dawns on Kurzweil that he has no trouble turning people into machines because he already considers them to be machines, and we don't follow the same way of imagining things. Kurzweil's transhumanist dream is only possible on the stunted vision of a human person based on a computational, disembodied, and individualistic, non-social view of consciousness. So obviously, personal, as we've described it in the first 20 minutes or so, has disappeared. The personal human identity based on recognition by and responsibility to others, we talked about, is reduced to information patterns. Communication becomes information exchange. Now, you have to think critically. Is that how we begin to think about language, about conversing with other people and so on? Whatever the world Kurzweil envisions is not a world for human persons. So our long-range problem is not that we will actually develop machines with human-like intelligence. Here I agree completely with a lot of philosophers that will remain nameless, that computers or AI neither think nor understand anything because they lack an embodied, self-transcendent human consciousness, the way I tried to describe it with the person. Without a human living body, artificial intelligence lacks the kind of coping, knowing one's way around of understanding that an embodied person has, and that makes a child more skillful than any robot or computer. Computers don't think, they don't understand, and they never will. If you start thinking that way, you've forgotten what understanding and thinking actually is. Now, it is true that artificial intelligence proves successful in isolated microworlds. Like you've heard, right? This is the great advance. They beat chess players. They win at Jeopardy. But as one of the philosophers says, that may be because it's a micro word taken out of context. But they're no good at finding you a life partner, no good at building a family, and certainly no good at serving you as a spiritual guide. So stop talking to Siri. No, the real danger is that we actually begin to believe that they can do those things. That's the problem. The real danger is that we reduce ourselves to computational machines and that our actual human skills of living lives worthy of the image of God atrophy. So the prevalent, largely unquestioned use of technology in education, communication, law enforcement, business management discourages critical thought, discourages embodied social engagement, discourages the struggle for wisdom, discourages contact with nature, and leads to the atrophy of physical and mental self-discipline. In short, we risk losing all the habits that cultivate personhood. So certainly, technology should assist us in becoming better persons rather than diminish our humanity. But in the end, I think we should accept the caution of one of these philosophers, Hubert Dreyfus. I'm going to end with this quotation because I think it's wonderful. He says, "Man's nature is indeed so malleable that it may be on the point of changing again. If the computer paradigm becomes so strong that people begin to think of themselves as digital devices on the model of work in artificial intelligence, then, since for the reasons we have been rehearsing, machines cannot be like human beings, then human beings may become progressively more like machines. So our risk is not the advent of superintelligent computers, but of subintelligent human beings." Okay, thanks for your attention.